This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's ramp season. Look on the dappled forest floor. Look for a carpet of green. Each plant with two long leaves on a sturdy stalk, a dark pink or purple color near the base of the leaves, but transitioning to white as it plunges into the ground. And beneath the soil, a small bulb with tenacious roots. Its flavor is a garlicky one, and you can cook with all parts of the plant. A delicious addition to spring meals. But you have to be cautious. You can overharvest these plants, especially if you're not the only person raiding the patch. Today on the show, we're going to learn how to be ethical foragers, and we'll talk about all kinds of wild edibles that you can add to your diet in the New England spring, summer, and fall. I'm joined now by Les Hook and Nova Kim, professional wild food gatherers who work with restaurants across the state. Welcome back, Les and Nova.
Welcome, Jay. Yeah.
And don't think you can hide that scowl, that cringe from me. You guys hate the word foragers, which I know I used anyway, but remind me why you hate foraging as a word.
Well, the etymology of foraging goes back to the 14th century. And for 90,000 years, we've been hunters and gatherers. And it is
not poachers and foragers.
That's right. And it's very similar. Now, he'll get mad at me for saying this, but I think there's a lot of good collectors that have never heard themselves referred to as anything other than foragers who do it properly. However, the amount of knowledge that it takes to properly collect, it's time that they came out of the woodwork and actually are called what they deserve, which are collectors and gatherers and wildcrafters, because they've earned that and they should not still have a derogatory term attached to them.
So you do think it's still derogatory? I mean,
absolutely.
Foraging now has become this word. The word itself has cachet. And Les, I know you're shaking your head, but I think a lot of people refer to themselves as sort of hobby foragers and love that idea. So you still think
they've never heard anything else.
So isn't it a good word now?
No.
No. You can't make a bad word a good word.
That's kind of what it amounts to.
So when you talk about the work that's involved in knowing the plants, knowing how to harvest them, knowing how to use them, Les, tell me a little bit about that, what it takes to know how to be a good wildcrafter and what you and Nova have learned.
Well, basic thing is if you're going to be a wildcrafter, not a forager, you don't need to know whether it's one bed. You need to know whether it's 100. And you pick them beds. Some years you don't go back for 5 years. But the more beds you know, the less you're going to overharvest. So you just keep learning more and more beds. You don't just stop at one or two. And that's my main goal. And then we try to pick as many things as we can without killing them. I mean, in this thing, we got 27 or 8 different plants here. And I think we might have killed 3. The rest of them are you just kind of pick the top off and make it grow like you would have gotten. So it's kind of cool.
All right, so we're on the radio here. Nova, tell us about this box that you and Les have in front of you.
Well, it was kind of put together in a hurry. So there's only, like you said, 27 or 28.
Only 27 or 28.
Well, somebody said, well, there's not many wild greens out yet because we haven't got the rains.
We were at Twin Farms yesterday, and wanted wild greens, and they said, probably isn't enough yet. And I said, oh, I think you'll be surprised.
So when we leave here, we've got to collect because they just opened back up again.
Yeah.
But what we have, actually, we would have had more, but we were counting on your lawn.
VPR is under construction.
We don't
have much of a lawn at
the
moment.
We forgot to get the sorrel, and Les said, not to worry. They have plenty of sorrel on the lawn. We just won't tell them it's on the lawn.
And the dandelion blossoms are normally on your lawn, but they weren't there this year.
No. Last time you guys were here, you did get quite a bit from our front yard, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, when you're in a hurry, you know. But that's the thing. When you're collecting, though, you have to know the location that you're collecting from. And show and tell is one thing. For eating is another. And 99% sure is not sure enough on identification. And you have to be certain that the areas you're collecting from are clean. Now, let's be clear here. We don't live in Egypt, so we can't live in a serious case of denial that every place has had some touch of the modern society. So you have to do it within as good a judgment as you possibly can.
Because you have to worry about maybe there have been pesticides on the fields or maybe, you know, if you're near a road, you may be getting certain kinds of things that are washing into the soil, for example.
Yeah, you have to make certain that if you're collecting off of somebody's farm or that you know them and you know what they're doing. Because and road crews can come through and without the person even realizing. So you've got to be very attentive and pay attention to the plants themselves because the plants will tell you if somebody's been through. So
how will the plants tell you?
Well, you'll see if they're starting to shrivel up. You'll see if there's a residue. There's all kinds of ways.
See, we still got people spraying power lines, spraying roadside, spraying anything they can get to. You know, it's still a big business.
We're talking today about wild crafting, gathering, not foraging. Unless we'll talk about that once Nova and Les leave. We'll mention that word again. And listeners, if you have a question, they're helping to educate us on the art of finding these wild edibles and what goes into it and how to do it ethically. So if you have a question about it, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. In a couple of minutes, we'll be switching to how to cultivate mushrooms at home. But now, again, we are looking at all of these wild edibles. So share your thoughts with us. And Les, you're handing something over. What are you handing over?
I'm handing you over. Taste the first one nearest you first.
This one. Yeah, okay. Very fresh, crunchy. Not super strong. You know, you sort of have a sense that maybe it's going to be chive-like, but it's not a very strong spice.
Works really good on pizza or on flatbread.
What is it?
It's the fresh top of daylilies coming up.
It's the top right here, the white part.
So Les is holding what looks like a really gnarly root, sort of yellow with these bulbs and strings, and then on the top it's this white part, and that's what comes out of the ground? Is that
That's a new growth.
So that's a daylily.
Yep.
And by the way, all parts of the daylily are edible.
So you could eat those roots, those dark roots, too.
You've got some right on your plate there.
Oh, so so I have two parts of the daylily here on my plate. So one is the white top part, and then this is the root part?
Right.
Yep.
So the root has a little bit of a stronger flavor and is a little bit harder and crunchier.
Right,
but both
crunchy.
Of them would be nice on a salad.
That's
very
right.
Mild, not really something that's going to alarm people who are anti-spice.
And when you're clearing out and your beds, you have to give them space. So when you're doing that, there you have a perfect source of food and you haven't harmed your daylily bed.
Oh, so this is something that you could do if you're just trying to sort of loosen up your daylily patch.
That's right.
All right, now what are you handing me?
Well, it's a wild, it's original mint, right?
Oh, yeah. This smells more like a spearmint than...
Well, that's a black mint. That's the only native mint that we have.
All I don't think much of it because it's strong.
All the other mints are escapes. This is the one that grows along in the riverbeds themselves, and it's a black stalk.
This is a slightly different flavor than any of the mints that, as you said, would have been brought here and cultivated. It's it tastes almost a little bit less minty or less sort of generically minty in a way. But it's lovely, and the plant is beautiful. It's got this beautiful sort of purple ribbing to it.
Right.
Is that why it's called the black mint?
The black mint, right.
This is delicious. So I have some questions from you, from listeners who have been wanting to weigh in. Silas just says, it's amazing how one can walk out into any field and get more than a few meals worth of good food within a short period of time. And then Kevin says, probably the first thing I forage for in Vermont in spring are checkerberries. Their green leaf and red berry are visible even when the snow is still on the ground. The checkerberry leaf in olden days was made into mountain tea, but I use the leaf and berry to make a very old Vermont recipe of sap beer, a recipe that calls for only checkerberry, sap, yellow birch bark, and yeast. Raisins are optional.
Okay, the checkerberry is also the wintergreen. That's the wintergreen plant. And if you want to make something really good and you don't want to go through all of the intense effort, we're kind of lazy in that sense, you can take just a really nice raw honey and you can either drop the berries or a leaf or two in it and you can leave it for a very short period of time and you have the most wonderful wintergreen flavor honey.
Ooh, that does sound good. And what do you use this black mint for?
Well, the black mint is used as a side. One of the chefs likes to take it and you put it in milk and you let it steep in that, and then you can make the best mint custard and flavorings and things.
Oh, that does sound delicious. Yeah. We have a tweet from A. Minor who says, I have yet to see nettles. They're way behind this year. Is that what you guys are finding?
I didn't find any yesterday.
Is that unusual at this time of year?
Yeah.
It's all unusual. Most of the things are much more advanced.
I mean, I found some bracken ferns yesterday, which should not be out for another month.
So you're finding things that are
early
year.
We're finding some things that are early and some things that should have been here aren't here yet.
Why do you think that is, given such a mild winter? Why would we have
It's called climate change.
Because it messes up the whole growing pattern. I mean, you don't need a mild winter. You need a normal cold winter, then you need warm spring. But we don't get that anymore.
See, we're seeing that in the mushrooms as well. What has happened is that we used to get the nice deep snow, and then we'd get the freeze, but the soil very seldom froze. Now we're getting the hard freezes and may or may not get the snow. And so it's driving that frost right down into the ground, and so it's affecting a whole lot of things.
Again, our number, if you'd like to ask Les Hook and Nova Kim a question, is 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Christina in Underhill. Hi, Christina. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question about ramps. I live in Underhill on a hillside with some nice woods and little streams that run, and I have a couple of patches of ramps that I very carefully select from. But I'm wondering, can I dig some up with their roots and move them closer to my house so I don't have to hike quite as far into the woods?
Yeah, absolutely you can. And also you have two things out in those woods if you get to looking. The one is came maybe 20, 25 years ago, is you have wild leeks and wild ramps in the woods. The wild leek is the one with the totally white stalk, and it is a little less intense than the ramp, which is the red-stalked one. But, yes, you can move that in closer.
And how do you move them? Do you just pick up a big chunk of soil with them? You want to keep them intact in the soil?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we also got a note from Just T, who says, I'd love to hear about sustainable foraging. Sorry, Les and Nova. Ramp leaves are just as flavorful as the roots and make a great pesto. Please leave the bulbs to grow for future years. So how do you think about this? Because we have heard...
Well, I have a real problem with this. If you take and you take off the top of your plants and they don't have enough green to feed the bulb, you're going to kill the plant. So in the process of feeling like you're doing something really good, you could be doing something really bad because they have to have that green to help feed the bulb. And I just want to address one thing on the foraging very quickly. If you look in the New York Times, particularly this time of year, how wonderful the forages are and how great all the wild ramps are. And then in about 2 to 3 weeks, invariably, it'll be followed up. Well, some forager went out and raped the woods. And a forager is the one who would have raped the woods. But you can't be both a good guy and a bad guy because it denotes the same terminology. So that's why we are so adamant about trying to separate the two.
Well, it seems to me that there's acres and acres and acres of ramps now. I mean, now that with the turkey, we're really getting... I mean, I don't even pick a ramp unless it's 20, 30 acres of them. I mean, you can't walk without treading on them, so I don't have to worry about over-harvesting.
Well,
in that situation.
And we only take a very small yeah. portion.
But I have heard that, you know, if you're harvesting an area, especially if you don't know who else is going out there too, which is the case for a lot of people in a lot of woods, mm-hmm. especially, you know, if this is something that you just do occasionally, that you need to be pretty careful, especially with ramps, because it is possible to over-harvest.
We only saw one place they were over-harvested, and that was where they were doing it as part of a CSA thing, and they would just...
Commercial.
Moved in, help, and they just
dug
everything.
One of the things that we do, whether it's fiddleheads or ramps or something like this, if you see an area where somebody is collecting, we leave. We don't even attempt to collect a few from there. We go to another site.
But you got to remember, we live in a state where they still do clear cuts, and they don't care.
Clear cuts.
Yeah. They can wipe out a ginseng bed or a wild leek bed, and they don't have to apologize.
So think about that.
1-800-639-2211. If you've thought about it, if you have something you'd like to say and share with us, our number is 1-800, again, 639-2211. BHA says, you can come to my house in Fairfax if you want nettles. They're starting to come up and are a big problem for me every year. So BHA would love for you to come clear out the nettles. And let's hear from Sean calling in from Wethersfield. Hi, Sean. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Hi, Jane.
We're with a eighth grade class at Wethersfield School, and it just happens that today was our day for a wild edibles feast.
Wow! What are you having?
Well, we gathered acorns, and then we went through this long process of leaching the tannins out and making a flour out of it. So we made acorn pancakes from the recipe from my side of the mountain. And we did, fiddleheads, dandelions, and nettles. And a couple of the kids in eighth grade and one in seventh grade brought in turkey that they'd shot on Uke weekend. And we marinated that in apple cider vinegar and birch syrup. And then we also have a little bit of birch sap to drink. So that was our feast. And the funniest thing about it, the kids can tell you more, but as we were finishing our meal, the Cisco truck backed into the loading dock of the school. And I was able to point to the truck and be like, well, that is the opposite of what you just enjoyed.
And it sounds like you've got the students there, and they can give a thumbs up or thumbs down or maybe a shout. Was this actually tasty for your students? Did they like the meal?
Yeah,
it was
really good.
It was good.
Any special comments? Anything particular?
The turkey
was really sweet.
The maple syrup and the acorn pancakes. Yeah.
The pancakes tasted almost like regular pancakes.
Say yes if you like the nettles.
Yes.
Hey, how do you like that?
Maybe.
Yeah. Come on, Sean. We know they're getting extra credit if they say they like this meal. That is awesome. Thank you so much for calling in. I can't believe this is the day you're having your wildcrafted meal. How cool. And yeah, who wouldn't want acorn pancakes and maple syrup and sap, birch sap? Oh my gosh. Sean, thanks. This was great. We'd love a picture. If you want to send us a picture of your meal, we'll post it on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Lesson Nova, what do you think? Sounds like a pretty good meal.
Sounds like a great meal. They could have expanded a lot, but one of the things that I don't think a lot of people realize is they could have used spruce needles for seasoning on their turkey. They can use balsam. That's a little sweeter. You can use white pine. These are good seasonings.
Over the spruce.
Yeah, those are all good seasonings. It's the young tips that you can really eat, and those haven't come out yet, but you can use that for seasoning just like you would rosemary.
Beautiful tea.
And so you just eat, these are just, the tips off the spruce.
Well, those aren't the tips. You're going to wait for the new growth, which should have been here.
Got it.
Okay, so this is just the established needles that you can use, too. But in Scandinavia, they're very smart to get their kids to get enough vitamin C. They used to take all the new growth, particularly off of white pine, the candles, and they would put them in sugar and boil them so that way they'd get their vitamin C. That was a hard candy.
Have you had it?
Yeah, it's very good.
Oh, yeah.
We do this at Green Mountain College with our students.
Spruce
we're teaching.
Ice cream is the best ice cream
you've ever had.
You've
never had ice cream until you've had
Spruce ice cream. I've got to talk to Ben and Jerry and see if they want to get into this.
Yeah, why didn't you guys bring any of that for me? Now, that would have been good. Les, you just, this is a trout lily leaf that you've handed me?
Just taste it. You don't have to eat the whole thing.
Well, I didn't know you could eat trout lilies.
They're very good.
Oh, yeah.
Very good in salads.
Young, tender ones.
Nice flavor.
Mm, it is nice, although I still have the spruce taste in my mouth, too, which is problematic now. But, yeah, that is nice. That has a – I didn't know that trout lilies were edible at all.
Well, you can make so many salads in the summertime. From now on, it's just different flavors.
Your violet leaves, your violets. Mm-hmm. There's, so many coltsfoot. You can sauté the coltsfoot blossom. You can sauté in butter and with rice. Yeah, there's virtually unlimited the things that you can do.
Can you eat the trout lily flowers? So if people are unfamiliar with trout lilies,
I wouldn't recommend.
Okay, so don't eat the flowers. The flowers are yellow, and they shoot straight up from these two trout lily leaves, which are dappled like trout, which is how they get their name. But they're beautiful on the forest floor.
And I want to address one thing about that in sustainability, is that you will read that you can eat the tuber off of the trout lily. And it's true, you can. But we don't. And if we're taking something that has like two leaves, we'll only take one leaf. Clintonia, or the blue bead lily, is really good when it's young.
It tastes just
like cucumber. But you would only take one of the three leaves. And so if they tell you that some of these, like spring beauty, are that you can eat the tuber, you can, but I wouldn't. Because now you are getting into not having the sustainability.
You two have this knowledge from a lifetime, mm-hmm. and many of us don't. It's not something that we have a lifetime of knowledge to pull from. So where do you recommend people get started if they want to learn this stuff?
Well, they could take one of the accredited courses at Vermont Tech or at Green Mountain College, where I don't know if you realize it, but it's the first accredited courses in wild food gathering. And while crafting, you may be able to learn mycology and botany, but the actual practice of collecting them and how to handle it. I would suggest that you get on some good walks. Now, the problem is that one of the things that we've seen is sometimes somebody will get a little bit of knowledge and then they set themselves up as an expert. And that's worrisome, and I don't know how to get around that. I wish I did.
Well, I think it's still in a DNA. I think it's not hard to learn wild food. I think we should all
good
go out and share it with our kids. And I think it's very easy to learn. Get a few books, really, really don't take any chances and just go for it.
One of the things we just came back from Guatemala, and one of the things that we really like down there is they collect in family groups, three generations at least. And that's how you pass the knowledge on. Deep knowledge is lost in one generation. That's the problem.
We got a question from Margaret who wants to know how to preserve ramps for later use. I mean, my favorite way is just to pickle them, but what do you guys think?
We love drying them. We cut them on a diagonal thing. They look like dried macaroni when you get done, and we like drying them.
But one of the things I've learned when we dehydrate them and you're cutting them, you have to cut them on the diagonal. Because that's the only way they dry. And one of the things that I think that will surprise people that when you're doing that and you're cutting them is the amount of sugar that you encounter, because that just blew my mind. I just don't associate sugar with ramps and leaks. But when you're cutting them, you'll see it all on your neck.
Hmm. So what about fiddleheads? Foraging M. And, oh, I'm sorry.
It's that F word. There's that F word.
I'm so sorry. But what about harvesting fiddleheads?
You should only pick maybe two. If it's got 12 or 13 in it, you maybe should pick two or three.
Okay.
You never, and always skip around. Don't pick them all on one side. Mm-hmm. And all you have to do is bend them outward, and they just snap off. Never use a knife. Just bend them over, and just like asparagus, they'll snap right off.
So you snap, and you snap them right at
just
the top.
Snap them
you just
outward.
Want
just
the fiddlehead.
Snap them
you only want the fiddlehead, and you don't ever want it more than about, oh, what is it, 6 inches?
Well, yeah.
No, what I'm saying is when they come up that high.
Oh, I see.
You don't want to take them right directly out of the crown. And if you get much beyond that, then you're leaving these tall stalks and stuff.
They got to be at least 2 inches tall before you bend them over, because you don't want to hurt the ones inside. They ain't come out yet.
Okay, so when the ferns are starting to emerge, you wait until those stalks are about 6 inches.
6 inches. And the reason for that is that, again, most plants will try to heal an injury. So if you are picking them when they're 6, 8, 10, 12 inches tall, you may get the good fiddlehead, but then that plant has to strain to try to heal that. So the less distance that it has to do, the better.
All right. I'm holding a fiddlehead, which I love fiddleheads. And I love just sauteing them a little bit, and you still get that nice crunchy flavor.
Yep.
Is there any other way that you recommend eating fiddleheads?
You can steam them.
Yeah.
Put them on the boil and boil them about 10 minutes and then drop your poached eggs in there, and they're really good that way for breakfast.
Okay. All right. That sounds good. All right. You handed me one more thing here, Les.
Well, I'm trying to keep up with some of this stuff that's not quite as well used as a fiddlehead. I mean,
now, that's called itadori in Japan. That's also everybody's nemesis. That's Japanese knotweed.
Aha.
Now, here's the thing about it. We should encourage, if you don't like Japanese knotweed, eat it out of existence. Don't try to poison it. But that is very good as an edible. And also, it is top-notch medicinal. It's also a top-notch medicinal, particularly for Lyme disease.
Why? What does it do for Lyme disease?
Well, it has the resveratrol in it, and I don't know exactly, but it's effective against all kinds of things. It's a very useful plant.
And how do you eat it? Because for people who can't picture it, it's a plant, the roots look like, or the tips look like they're, in many cases, quite pink, but it has sort of segments almost like asparagus or like...
Well, for years we've sold it as red asparagus.
Aha. So that makes sense then. And so do you eat it? You cook it like asparagus?
You cook it like asparagus.
Does it make your pee stink like asparagus?
No.
Okay.
No, it doesn't.
It's more like rhubarb than it is asparagus, but you can cook it till it tastes like asparagus. You flavor it, right?
Yeah. My favorite dish of all wild dishes is that particular plant steamed and boiled and then put in some cream and put a tent over it and bake it.
Oh, that sounds delicious. All right, you got one more thing, Les. You're handing it over.
I'm trying to hand you things that should be used and nobody's using.
All right, cowslip?
Yeah.
And
cowslip,
how do we use this?
Or marsh marigold.
Big, round plants and then big, beautiful flowers that almost look like
buttercups. I put the flowers on there just so you could see it, but you don't need the ones with the flowers. You just do the buds.
Here is the thing. This is a traditional Vermont dish, but a lot of people don't use it. But you cannot eat it raw, and you have to turn off the water. You can't use the liquid.
Okay, so boil it and then toss the water.
Yeah. Toss the water. And it is a delicious plant, and more people should be using it.
All right, well, I'll be at your house tonight at about 7:30. I'll
okay.
See you then. Nova Kim and Les Hook are professional wild food gatherers who work with restaurants across the state.
Actually, now only
Randolph.
Twin Farms.
Now only Twin Farms. Oh, I see you're exclusive. Ooh,
yeah.
Even more famous now.
No, we're just doing too many other things.
Well, I appreciate you coming by the show. Thank you so much. Nice
Thank
to
you.
See you both
yep.
again. Coming up, we're going to to talk about mushrooms and how you can grow your own mushrooms at home for fun or profit, I suppose. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We were just talking about the wild edibles you can venture out to find in nearby forests and fields. But what about farming, what's often thought of as something that you either buy in the store or get out in the woods? Our next guest is a shiitake evangelist. He can teach you how to cultivate and harvest shiitake mushrooms right in your own yard, though you must have patience, Grasshopper, if you're going to do it. Nick Leskovsky cultivates mushrooms at Dana Forest Farm in Waitsfield, which is putting on the 6th annual Shiitake-palooza this weekend. And if you have a question for him, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Nick, it's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, Jane.
Shiitake-palooza, what happens there?
All right. Well, first I should clarify that Shiitake-palooza is its 6th annual, but it's going to be held in Middlebury, Vermont this year at the Eddy Farm. And while I run Dana Forest Farm in Waitsfield, the Eddy Farm is where we're going to be putting it on. And to find that, you go on South Street Extension about a mile past Porter Hospital in Middlebury, and that's where we'll be. And about the event, Shiitake-palooza is basically a fun and educational gathering to learn about how to grow shiitake mushrooms primarily. But this year, we're also going to be teaching participants about a few other types of mushrooms, too.
So let me take you through this quickly. You know, you have people at this event, and you're teaching them how to grow their own shiitake mushrooms and then, you know, some others, as you said. But walk me through the steps, starting with what sounds like sort of a bad science fiction movie inoculation, which it sounds like from the Shiitake-palooza Facebook page you do at dawn. So it sounds even more nefarious. But start with inoculation.
It definitely takes the approach of many hands make light work. So what we've done to prepare for Shiitake-palooza over the last few weeks is we've been teaming up with our loggers, and we've been harvesting a particular tree species and preparing the logs to a certain length and basically stacking them up at the beginning of our assembly line. And then what we do is we take special specialty tools and we drill holes into the logs. And mind you, these logs are about 3 to 4 feet in length, so they're able to be picked up by, you know, one person and moved around. And so we space holes throughout the logs evenly and on all sides of the logs, and then we move it down the assembly line to the next station, which is the inoculation station. And at the inoculation station is where we inject these holes with shiitake spawn. And then we put a cap on each of these holes to seal them up. And then from there, we move the logs to our laying yard, where they will spend the next year incubating, and essentially the mycelium that we've put into those logs will take about a year to grow before they're ready to produce any mushrooms.
And in fact, you're letting people go home with their own logs if they would like to do this at home themselves.
That's right. That's right. So we're hoping we can get a lot of people to show up to help us go through the process, learn how to do it, and at the end of it, take home a log. And this year, actually, we're also teaming up with a group in Hadley, out of Hadley, Massachusetts, whose name is Fungi Ally. And they are spawn producers in Hadley, and they'll be coming up and joining us for the weekend and also setting up shop. So if people want to grow more than just one log at home, they can purchase spawn from Fungi Ally and go home with it and inoculate logs at home as well.
Let's go to Jackie, who's calling in from Brattleboro. Hi, Jackie. Go right ahead.
Hi. I picked up a little pamphlet at my local food co-op here in Brattleboro. And it's about mushroom cultivation using plug spawn.
which is like what you guys are talking about, right?
Yes.
Hello?
Yeah, we hear you, Jackie.
Great. Okay, great.
Yeah, so there's a few different varieties of basically types of spawn that can be used for cultivation. And it shows up in a couple different forms. It can show up as sawdust spawn. It can show up as dowel plugs, otherwise known as plug spawn. It can show up as thimble spawn, where you actually just use your thumb to pop little spawn pieces inside of logs. So it's really just it's kind of a variety of media that's used to inoculate logs. And we tend to use the sawdust spawn method just out of efficiency for time. But plug spawn, it's essentially the same type of thing, just a slightly different method. But overall, the idea is the same.
So, Jackie, are you going to do it?
Well, I tried the sawdust, and I had to keep that plastic bag in my house, and I don't know, it just didn't work too well for me. So, what I'd like to try is the plug spawn on a tree stump that I have. Hmm. I have one out in my side yard. I'm in the middle of town, so I can't walk into, I have to walk 5 or 10 minutes, not too far, to get to the woods. But if I could just walk outside my door and find mushrooms on my tree stump that I know I can use, I'd be thrilled.
Jackie, that does sound fabulous. I feel the same way. But Nick, as you mentioned, it takes a year just to get the first harvest of these shiitakes that you're talking about. And how much do you actually get from one log? I mean, if somebody's a big mushroom fan, is this an efficient way to have your own mushrooms, or are you going to be eating very few?
Stump inoculation is definitely one way to go. It's obviously all feasible. Now, the trick here is, understanding the type of tree that you want to inoculate and also the type of mushrooms that will be compatible with that tree. So for shiitake, for example, I'll concentrate on that. We like to use oak and hard maple. Beech can work all right, red maple. But there are, sort of selective tree species that work better than others. In terms of the quantity that you would get per log, what we find in the Northeast is we can get about 2 solid harvests per year from one log. And the varying amount that we get from each harvest is usually between about 1/4 pound to 1/2 pound. That said, we can get potentially up to 1 pound of mushrooms per log per year. But the cool thing is once you inoculate that log once, it will produce mushrooms for up to 5 years, potentially even longer. So over the course of its lifetime, you can reinitiate the fruiting process on the log and actually be able to potentially maybe even get 5 or 10 pounds of mushrooms from that one log after you've inoculated it only once.
Well, there's plenty more to learn, and you can do it this weekend if you care to go to Shiitakepalooza. It's this weekend at the Eddy Farm in Middlebury. We've been talking with Nick Laskowski, who cultivates shiitake mushrooms at Dana Forest Farm in Waitsfield, and you will see him at Shiitakepalooza. Nick, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much, Shane. And you guys can find out a lot more on our Facebook page.
And we have a link to that right at vpr.net. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's time now for Dorothy's List, our series about the books nominated for Vermont's Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award. And today we have a winner. VPR's Amy Noyes has the announcement.
More than 3,200 Vermont middle schoolers voted for this year's Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award, and it was a tight race. But in the end, El Defo was a clear winner. El Defo is the second graphic novel to win the award in its 60-year history. The first was Smile by Raina Telgemeier in 2012. An El Defo author and illustrator, Cece Bell, says that book inspired her to create El Defo.
I have a lot to be grateful for in terms of Raina Telgemeier's work. She's been very, very inspirational, and we've actually become very good friends, which has been the icing on the cake for me.
Both Smile and El Defo are autobiographical, and Belle says until she read Smile, she hadn't hit on the best way to tell her own story.
I had been putting off this story for a long time. I had been telling a lot of the stories that are featured in the book. I had been telling a lot of people these stories over the years, and I always got people laughing. I knew it was a good story. And then later, I happened to read Raina Telgemeier's book, Smile. And once I saw that, I realized that the graphic novel format was perfect for my personal story. And I think I was just waiting for the right format to come along.
Belle's personal story starts when she contracts meningitis as a preschooler and loses her hearing. In El Defo, Cece and other characters are pictured as rabbits. Belle says that was an important choice.
The reason for that is that rabbits have very, very big ears, and they can hear really well. And I was trying to create this visual metaphor of being the only rabbit in an entire school of rabbits whose giant ears were there and visible, but they did not work. They were broken. It was effective to have the ears really long and on top of my head because the cords that were connected to my hearing aid that went more to the sides of my head in real life, to my ears. In the book, those cords go all the way up over my head and are very, very visible, which is closer to how I felt. I felt very conspicuous and like everyone was looking at me. So that kind of fit really well.
And there's another reason.
Also, bunnies are cute, and you can't go wrong with bunny rabbits.
The Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award is one of many honors Belle has earned for writing El Defo, including a Newbery honor, but she didn't start out as a writer.
For a long time, I worked as a freelance designer and illustrator and with sort of a dream to get into children's books. And every now and then would send out illustrations to publishers and just kept getting rejected. Nobody liked my stuff enough to have me illustrate their books. So I read somewhere that I would more likely get into children's books if I did both the writing and the illustrating. So I thought, all right, I'll try writing a book. And that's what I did. My first book was called Sock Monkey Goes to Hollywood. It was published in 2003. That was kind of my path towards children's books. But I sort of happily fell into the writing part and ended up loving the writing part maybe even more than the illustrating part, which is kind of a surprise to me still.
Belle's ability to tell her story in words and pictures really connected with Richmond fourth grader Hannah Dietrich.
This is a really funny book and, like, has a meaning to it and a moral. And, like, it really tells you if you're, like, someone different from the world.
Books that challenge kids to think and react with the story are a priority for the adults who choose the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award nominees that young readers vote upon. We sat down with award committee chairperson Hannah Peacock and Vermont Department of Libraries Youth Services consultant Sharon Colvin to find out some of the books on the new list. There are four graphic novels on the new list. Colvin says she likes Roller Girl by Victoria Jameson.
This is about a 12-year-old girl who is trying to find herself. She has kind of a struggle with a friend. She has a best friend. They do everything together. And this summer, the main character wants to do roller derby camp. And the other friend says, I want to do dance camp. And it's like, well, how can we be friends if we're not doing everything together? And, you know, every child can relate to that kind of struggle. And it's also got this wonderful girl power message. You know, she's 12 and she's out there roller skating and playing roller derby, which is an intense sport. I highly, highly, highly recommend this one.
One of Peacock's picks is Shadows of Sherwood by Vermont author Kekla Magoon.
And this is the first in a series. It's called the Robin Hoodlum series. It's a little bit of a Big Brother society. It's a modern Robin Hood tale because Robin Hoodlum becomes sort of the one who helps the poor by stealing from the rich a little bit, as Robin Hood goes. And so she finds a couple of other kids who are runaways for different reasons from the poorer side of town. And they sort of band together to figure out how to fight the corrupt government.
Alex Gino's novel George is also nominated for next year's Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award. For Colvin, the selection of this particular book makes her proud and excited.
And the reason is this is a very cutting-edge topic. It's about a fourth grader, transgender child. This child's name is George, but George was born a boy but feels like a girl. And it's a very innocent book. There is nothing sexual about this book. It's just about identity. And this whole story is adorable. The school is putting on a play of Charlotte's Web, and George really, really wants to play Charlotte. And, you know, George's teachers and family are just not, they don't understand what's going on. And George confides in a best friend who's fantastic, and they really talk about what does it mean to be a girl, and, you know, how can I explain this to people? And so they craft this elaborate plan so that George is able to play Charlotte in the school play.
And speaking of Charlotte's Web, Peacock's next pick is often compared to that children's classic. It's called Escape from Baxter's Barn by first-time author Rebecca Bond, who also illustrates the book.
It's a book about team of animals in a barn, including a house cat who sneaks out to sleep in the warm house and overhears some terrible news about how one of the brothers who owned Baxter's barn is going to burn it down. So the cat Burdock goes back and tells the other animals, we have to do something, and they just work together. There's like two massive horses, an old aging cow, Mrs. Brown, a couple of goats and a sheep, and a barn owl joins them at some point, and they just figure out a way to get out of this situation. And it's such a great book about celebrating our strengths and weaknesses, who can do what, and communication and friendship. And I think younger kids are going to love it, and older kids will enjoy it, but it's really a great book for the younger crowd.
Colvin says her next pick is a good read for all ages, including adults. It's called The Lightning Queen by Laura Riesau.
She's a phenomenal author. So this is a story about a boy named Teo who lives in the United States, but his grandfather lives in Oaxaca. And one summer when he's there, his grandfather pulls him aside and says, hey, I need your help. And he starts telling them this really involved, intricate, fantastic story about the Lightning Queen. And Teo's not sure how much of it is true and how much of it is, you know, a little bit of fantasy. But he tells a story about this gypsy girl who came to Oaxaca and was a fortune teller and all this fantastic stuff, and he fell in love with this girl. And so now he wants help tracking her down.
Dorothy Canfield Fisher nominees are grouped by books appropriate for different ages, from fourth grade through eighth grade. One of the books that Peacock recommends for older kids is I Am Princess X by Sherry Priest. The book starts with two friends, Libby and May, who create a comic book series together about Princess X. A few years later, Libby goes missing and is presumed dead.
And then as time goes on, they realize that there's more to this story. So 3 years later, so now that May's in high school, she starts seeing little stickers and patches all around town from her comic book. And she's like, who has this? Where did they get it? So it turns out it's been online for years. The comic book is now online and the story is going on. And she has to get to the bottom of what happened. Is Libby really dead? Who has her stuff? And what happens? And they get involved in the dark side of the internet pretty quickly. Her neighbor becomes her ally and helps her out. And it's pretty scary. It talks all about how dangerous the internet can be. But it's also a great story about friendship and perseverance and art and storytelling.
Art and storytelling are at the heart of the Dorothy Canfield Fisher program, encouraging middle grade students to read and inhabit stories that teach them about other people's lives and experiences. The books that Peacock and Colvin describe are among the 30 books nominated for next year's Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award, and Vermont middle school students will spend the next year reading them. In the spring, they'll vote for the book that will join El Defo as winner of the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Award. And before we go, there's one more winner to announce. This year, the Dorothy Canfield Fisher Book Award held a contest for students to design a new logo. And the winning logo was designed by Destiny Shealy, a seventh grader in Richford. You can see your logo of kids reading around a tree that has books for leaves and learn how she came up with the idea at vpr.net. For VPR News, I'm Amy Noyes.
And that wraps up our third season of Dorothy's List. If you missed some of the books we've discussed, go to vpr.net/Dorothy's List to learn about all the books, schools, and libraries that we've featured. And join us again in the fall when we'll hear about some of the books nominated for next year's Dorothy Canfield Fisher Children's Book Award. Dorothy's List is sponsored by the VPR Journalism Fund. A series of large hydroelectric dams along the Connecticut and Deerfield rivers will be sold at auction, and the state of Vermont is trying to decide, should it buy them? It's a compelling opportunity, but not without downsides. Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll look at whether state government should get into the energy business and try to purchase these hydro dams. You can share your thoughts with us. Write to vermontedition@vpr.net, and be sure to tune in live tomorrow at noon. Our producers are Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. We had assistance today from Sarah Matthews. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.